Chapter 9, The Dehumorizer. In the rare cases where running for the Senate is someone's first foray into politics, the candidate has generally had some notable success in another field, most often business, or the Spanish-American War. These first-time candidates generally fall into one of two categories. Category 1, I've been successful because I'm incredibly smart. I've always followed my own instincts, even when people said I was wrong, and I know what the hell I'm doing. I don't need to listen to anyone's advice. This apparently only works when you're running for president and get help from the Russians. Category 2. I've been successful in my field, and one reason I've been successful is that I know what I don't know and when I should rely on expert advice. One thing I definitely know is that I have no idea how to run for office. I better get some advice from experienced people. I fell squarely into category 2. As I would have ample opportunity to prove throughout the campaign, my own political instincts were not foolproof, but at least they were good enough to indicate from the jump that I'd need a lot of help to pull this off. This worried many of my friends who knew that I was thinking of running. "Please, Al," they'd beg me, "whatever you do, don't listen to those political consultants. They'll just make you sound like every other candidate." Or, "Please, please don't hire a bunch of political consultants. Political consultants are just beltway whores." One friend who didn't feel that way was political consultant Mandy Grunwald. I first met Mandy in 1993 when she was working for President Bill Clinton. Since then, she had made ads for both Paul Wellstone and Amy Klobuchar, so she knew Minnesota. When I floated the idea of running for the Senate to Mandy, she said, "Don't. It's a horrible life." So my friends needn't have worried. I was perfectly capable of rejecting advice from a political consultant. Mandy agreed to help with my campaign, but she cautioned that she'd be very busy with her work for Hillary Clinton's 2008 presidential race. In fact, as I discovered in trying to find a campaign manager, a lot of the political talent in the country had already signed up for a presidential campaign, be it for Hillary, for Barack Obama, who landed Jeff Blodgett, or for John Edwards, who, at the time, seemed like a fine fellow. Heading into 2007, the closest thing I had to a campaign manager was Andy Barr, a whip-smart, baby-faced 23-year-old who had been working for me since he was a sophomore at Harvard. Note on whip-smart. I noticed that in Double Down, their narrative of the 2012 presidential campaign, Mark Halperin and John Heilman promiscuously used the adjective whip-smart to describe individual staffers in both the Obama and Romney campaigns. Let's see how many times I can use it as a crutch before it wears out its welcome. Andy had been a key member of Team Franken, the ragtag gang of goofballs who help research lies and the lying liars who tell them. After graduating, Andy joined the radio show, and at 2 p.m. Central, he would shift from soundboard engineer and radio sidekick to political director of Midwest Values Pack, which meant he fielded requests for appearances and donations and acted as my body man at Bean Feeds. A body man on a campaign is the person, male or female, who makes sure you stay on schedule, briefs you about the people you're about to meet and any issues you should know about, and collects business cards from supporters who want to donate money or invite you to another Bean Feed or give you their screenplay that's just perfect for Eddie Murphy. MVP's other staffer was the whip-smart David Benson, 26, who had some actual campaign experience, about 18 months worth, some of it working for South Dakota Senator Tom Daschle. David proved extremely capable when it came to the nuts and bolts of campaign management. Things like budgets, campaign finance regulations, and human resources. For example, he was the one who realized that we needed a frank and somewhat grim employee handbook, covering things like how to report expenses or bomb threats, and how to act outside the office. You work for a political campaign, which means that whether you're on the clock or not, your actions leave an impression and ultimately affect people's perception of Al and of our organization. Sucks for you, but this is the life you chose. Traveling around the state with me in 2006, Andy had gotten to know the young organizers who work for the state party or for other campaigns. Several soon joined our team, like the burly, bald, resourceful Dusty Trice, who always knew a terrifying amount of Minnesota political gossip and couldn't be stumped by any logistical request. Need 300 red, white, and blue kazoos by midnight? Looking for a DFL-friendly coffee shop for an event in Beltrami County? Want a couple donkeys to march in your 4th of July parade? Dusty's answer was always the same. I got a guy. The next iteration of Team Franken was coming together. What they lacked in experience, they made up for in youthful enthusiasm and general whip-smartedness. Campaign manager or no campaign manager, I was ready to get started. You cannot be a candidate for public office and have a radio show on the air, at least not according to the Federal Election Commission and the Federal Communications Commission. And so, in a nod to my commitment to adhere to federal law, I announced that I was running for the United States Senate on February 14th, 2007, Valentine's Day, as I signed off the air for the last time. Then Franny and I went home and spent a romantic evening calling friends for money. Meanwhile, we released a 7-minute web video featuring me talking directly to camera, telling Minnesotans my story and Franny's, assuring them that I was ready to take seriously the responsibility I was asking for, and explaining that I was running to restore the middle class. Not for the first or last time, I invoked Paul Wellstone's words, "The future belongs to those who are passionate and work hard." That afternoon, the chairman of the Minnesota GOP, Ron Carey, held a press conference. In the spirit of Minnesota Nice and in the spirit of Valentine's Day, I'd like to welcome Al Franken into the race and offer a gift basket to Al on behalf of the Republican Party of Minnesota. I know what you're thinking. That was awfully sporting of him. I guess people are nice in Minnesota. But hold on. See, the basket was filled with stuff like a map of the state because, quote, "For over the last 30 years, Al has largely lived in Los Angeles and New York City," which was true except for the Los Angeles part. To, quote, help Al with his anger, there was also a DVD copy of Anger Management, starring, quote, his sidekick, Adam Sandler. Adam, of course, played my sidekick in our very popular Wayne's World movies. And to help Al keep up with what is happening in Hollywood, there is an issue of Entertainment Weekly. There are a bunch of other things that he had picked up at CVS, but you get the idea. In addition to painting me as a short-tempered carpetbagger, Carey also released to the press the first of what would be hundreds of research documents detailing examples of stuff I'd said or written over 35 years in comedy that Republicans said proved I was profane, rude, and just plain out of touch with Minnesota values. This was my first brush with the dehumorizer, a $15 million machine Republicans built using state-of-the-art decontextualizing technology. The dehumorizer's function was to take a joke and strip away everything that made it, well, a joke. When you do satire, you make use of things like irony, saying one thing while clearly meaning its opposite. And I'm pretty sure Republicans know what irony is because Ron Carey made extensive use of it in his press conference. But with the dehumorizer stripping away anything that made it clear I was engaging in irony or hyperbole or ambiguity or any number of other comic devices, Republicans could simply present my words to Minnesotans at face value. Without their comedic context, those words often weren't funny anymore, and in fact, they could appear downright offensive. Now, here's an example. In Rush Limbaugh's Big Fat Idiot, I was satirizing Republicans' willingness to balance the budget on the backs of the elderly, as well as their chronic underfunding of NASA. And I jokingly suggested that we kill two birds with one stone. Just start sending the elderly into space, and don't worry about whether we actually get them back. Continuing to riff off this modest proposal, I added another idea. Every Sunday, we put an elderly or terminally ill person in a rocket, fire it over the Snake River, and put it on pay-per-view. The revenues go straight into reducing the deficit. Did you laugh at that? No? Well, did you at least understand that I wasn't actually proposing to murder elderly Americans? Okay, good. But the dehumorizer removed the setup that made it clear that I was engaging in irony to further a satirical argument that was actually making a serious point. And in the Republicans' research document, it just read, Franken planned to reduce debt, blast the elderly in rockets over Snake River, and put it on pay-per-view. The dehumorizer was up and running. Fortunately, so was the Franken campaign. The day after the announcement, I visited a health clinic in Minneapolis where my friend Dr. Margie Hogan worked. I spent time meeting with healthcare providers and patients and listening to some of the horror stories that were commonplace before the passage of the Affordable Care Act. One of the stories Margie told me became a mainstay of my stump speech. It involved an incredibly promising 17-year-old girl from a Hmong family who was doing college-level work as a junior in high school. But she had lupus, and her family earned just enough money to no longer qualify for Minnesota Care, the program that covered low-income families in the state. The girl lost her health insurance. Lupus is a chronic disease, and the medication that controls it is extremely expensive. The girl told her parents to stop buying it so they could afford to take care of the other kids in the family. It broke their hearts, but she was right. They couldn't afford the medicine, not with everything else weighing on the family budget. So they stopped buying it. The next time Margie saw the girl was 6 weeks later, back in the hospital. But this time she was in the emergency room, suffering from renal failure. She had to be put on dialysis, and doctors thought she might have to be on dialysis for the rest of her life. Now that's wrong, I would tell crowds that had invariably gone quiet by this point in the story. But it's not just wrong, it's stupid. How much is this going to cost our system to give her dialysis throughout her life? How much is this going to cost her in terms of her potential and her quality of life? According to the most recent data, when my campaign began, there were 46.6 million Americans living without health insurance, including 21.5 million who work full-time, and worst of all, 8.3 million children. And on my radio show, I talked about this issue all the time with guests like Elizabeth Warren, who told me that half of all bankruptcies in America were tied to a medical problem. But at Bean Feeds, I met people who had lived it, or who would tell me about their sister or their cousin who had lived it. And traveling around Minnesota, stopping in cafes and coffee shops and VFW halls, I couldn't help but notice the flyers up on bulletin boards announcing barbecues or potlucks or spaghetti dinners to benefit families that had gone broke because someone had gotten very sick or been in a terrible accident. Getting a universal health care was always going to be a central focus of my campaign. But now, instead of talking about it just as a policy issue, I was also talking about it as a personal issue. Because that's what it is for so many Minnesotans. After that first event, we hit the road, holding two jam-packed labor rallies in northeastern Minnesota, one at the Labor Temple in Duluth, and another at a union hall in the tiny town of Nashwauk on the Iron Range. The range sits on the richest deposits of iron ore in the country. Rangers have been providing the iron ore for America's blast furnaces for well over 100 years. You may never have wondered where the ore for your blast furnaces come from, but if you have, the answer is that, almost certainly, it comes from the Iron Range. The range is largely Democratic because Rangers are heavily unionized. But they like their guns, they're socially conservative, though they have a lot more bars than churches. And even though Rangers live in and care for one of the most beautiful parts of the country, they're not terribly fond of environmentalists. I know what you're thinking. These sound like the kind of Democrats who wound up voting for Donald Trump. And you know what? You're right. A lot of them did. I got along well with Rangers, in part because I was a member of four unions myself. The Writers Guild, the Screen Actors Guild, the American Federation of Television Radio Artists, and the Directors Guild. Labor in Minnesota didn't really care that my unions were in jobs where you don't get your hands dirty or lift stuff or fix anything except a script. What they cared about was that I had paid my dues, literally, that I was a member in good standing, and that I understood what labor has done for this country. Unions gave us the 40-hour work week, the weekend, and the middle class. As we kept traveling the state, I met countless people at informal coffee shop get-togethers, or while I grabbed a bite at restaurants, or just waiting in line to pee at a Super America. The stories people told me began to inform what I said on the stump, and they still inform what I do as a senator. For example, at one point early in the campaign, we started doing roundtables on college campuses, small events where I'd try to do more listening than talking. The skyrocketing cost of college was always the first thing that would come up. Back when kids like Franny had used them to go to college, a full Pell Grant paid 80% of a college education, but now it was down to 35%. Students I met were working 20, 30, even a full 40 hours a week just to pay tuition. And that's in addition to going to school full time. Then at a roundtable at Minnesota State University, Mankato, I met a student named Casey Carmody, who told me that despite working 40 hours a week, he still couldn't afford his tuition, so he'd resorted to selling his blood plasma. In the car between events, I'd look out the window at the beautiful Minnesota landscape and think about how these issues I'd spent so many years talking about really affected people, resolving to do something to improve their lives. Okay, that's not true. Mostly, I made fundraising calls because that's what you have to do in the car. But sometimes, while I waited for people's outgoing voice messages to finish so I could leave a message inviting them to a fundraiser, I thought about Margie's lupus patient, or Casey Carmody selling his blood to get an education, or the miner in Hibbing who asked me, "What are you going to do to protect my pension?" Or the parents of soldiers serving in Iraq who asked me whether I could do anything to bring their son or daughter home. We finished our kickoff tour with a big Saturday afternoon rally at my junior high school in St. Louis Park, just a couple blocks from where I grew up. 1,200 enthusiastic supporters ignored a driving snowstorm and packed into the gym, with hundreds donating and signing up to volunteer. When I got home from the St. Louis Park rally, I decided to check out the prestigious internet to see if anyone had had any reaction to our incredible display of grassroots energy. I quickly found a website called Minnesota Democrats Exposed, where I read a headline saying something to the effect of "Disastrous Turnout at Franken Rally." Underneath was a picture of a nearly empty gym with our campaign signs hanging forlornly on the walls. Apparently, whoever had taken the photo had gotten in early and shot it before the crowd was let in. I showed this to Andy, who said, "Yeah, that's Michael Broadcorp. He's a right-wing blogger." "Oh," I said. "Well, he doesn't seem very ethical." I was more confused and angry. Why would anyone do that? Now, you may be thinking, aren't you the guy who wrote several books about how Republicans love to lie? I know, I guess it's just a little different when it happens to you. But I have to say, it was hard to resist the impulse to set the record straight when Republicans and their mouthpieces would lie about me, even when it was something small like how many people had shown up for a rally. And it was even harder when they would lie about my career in comedy. Every time I was attacked, very often unfairly, for something I'd said or written, I'd say that I understood the difference between what a satirist does and what a senator does, and assure Minnesotans that I wouldn't embarrass them in Washington, which was true. But it always felt a little wrong. What I really wanted to do was put these words back through a rehumorizer and turn them back into jokes again. Unfortunately, there's a saying in politics: when you're explaining, you're losing. As I would eventually learn, if not necessarily accept, in a campaign you can't correct every intentional or accidental misinterpretation of your words or your record or your ideas. And you especially can't litigate comedy.